Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Tonight, we'll talk about a new procedure to treat enlarged prostates.
This procedure differs from the other procedures that are available in that it is an anatomic dissection. The enlargement tissue is removed completely as opposed to just creating a channel through the enlargement tissue.
Plus, a persistent problem, lead poisoning.
It's important to realize that state by state, the prevalence of lead in housing is different. We have an older state.
And research on a rarely studied topic, depression among medical students and residents.
When we looked at the rates, the residents and the students, we found that the rate for depression was 3 times higher, and the rates for anxiety was up to 7 times higher than the general U.S. population.
Our checkup from the neck up and a poignant piece from our healing muse. That's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On tonight's show, the continuing dangers of lead to our children and what we can do about it. Plus, depression in our healthcare providers, the stigma and the real concern. But first, a new procedure to treat enlarged prostates. Benign prostatic hyperplasia affects 50% of men between the ages of 50 and 60 and 90% of men over the age of 80. And for decades, transurethral resection of the prostate, also known as TURP, has been the gold standard surgical treatment for this disease. But now there is a new procedure that treats these enlarged prostate glands with less risks and shorter recovery time. Here to tell us more about all of this is Dr. Jessica Panessa. She's assistant professor of urology at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Panessa. Thanks for coming in.
Hello.
So let's begin by helping us understand what BPH, or benign prostatic hyperplasia, is.
So the way I describe it to my patients is that the prostate gland in a young male is a gland that sits just below the bladder, and through the center of it runs the urethra, or the channel that you urinate through. It's a gland about the size of a walnut, and over time, the tissue in the center of the gland begins to grow, and as it expands, it pushes the original prostate to the outside. And if you think of the older male's prostate more of like an orange, the peel represents the original prostate, and the fruit of the orange would represent the enlargement tissue that causes blockage and makes it difficult for men to urinate.
So basically what happens is it's a normal process over time for the prostate to enlarge. I guess it happens at two different periods in life, around the time of puberty and later on. And as men age, just routinely, it does enlarge for the most part. Is that correct?
Right. Men will experience growth at different rates. Some men will have minimal growth and may experience significant symptoms, whereas other men will have significant growth and may have fewer symptoms.
But the symptoms are caused by the fact, as you mentioned, the urethra, which is the tube through which we urinate, gets pressed on by this enlarged tissue. Is that correct?
Right. So the enlarging tissue is wrapping around this channel, and it begins to create increased pressure, which the bladder has to try to compensate for in order to force urine past the blocking portion and out through the urethra.
Do we know what really causes this in some men as opposed to it not being a problem in others? Do we understand that?
So there's still a lot that we don't know about what makes one man have significant BPH versus another. We know that male hormones are permissive, but they're not necessarily causative of BPH.
So I read something that they're talking about testosterone, but they're also talking about this thing called dihydrotestosterone, or DHT. But are they just still at the process of trying to figure out what role these two things play?
We still have a lot to learn regarding the role of male hormones and how that impacts growth of the prostate.
So how common is this? I mean, in terms of this problem, where people actually come to you with a problem?
So this is actually very common. In my practice, it's obviously something that I probably see more of because it's my specialty area. But most urologists will have several patients with this complaint.
Is this likely to occur in particular populations? In other words, if you have certain medical conditions or family history, or is this just kind of random?
Although you can see certain populations may have more prevalence in patients with family history, may be more likely to develop BPH, BPH can actually affect men from all different demographics and at all different ages.
So tell us again what the symptoms are. In other words, how would you know or not know? But I mean, what symptoms would you be experiencing if you had BPH?
Men typically complain of urinary frequency, urinary urgency, hesitancy or taking a while to get your stream started, a feeling of incomplete bladder emptying. Many times men will get up at night to go to the bathroom, and some men will not be able to void at all, and we would call that urinary retention.
And some, I've read somewhere that there's also, sometimes is there an unusual color to the urine also, or a change in the urine?
So a lot of men will have some blood in their urine, which can come from the prostate. And anytime blood is seen in the urine, it's an indication that they should seek medical treatment.
How about the size of the prostate? Does that determine, I mean, is that an indicator if your prostate feels larger or seems enlarged, does that always go with the idea of blockage?
It may, but not necessarily. I have many patients whose prostates are very large and their symptoms are minimal and they don't have any major health risks due to their prostate, whereas I have other gentlemen with smaller glands with some enlargement, but not nearly as much as others, and they will have significant symptoms and may even have some very significant medical problems because of the blockage.
So the blockage can really lead to some significant medical problems.
Absolutely.
What are those?
The things that we really get concerned about are persistent bleeding from the prostate, stones that form in the bladder because the bladder's not emptying properly, the inability to urinate completely, and that would be urinary retention.
So what role do decongestants, these over-the-counter decongestants, play in this whole picture?
Oftentimes, men with mild symptoms may find that their symptoms are significantly exacerbated after taking over-the-counter cold remedies, allergy medications, alcohol consumption, or other medicines that may be prescribed by other physicians. And this exacerbation can sometimes lead to urinary retention.
So it can make things worse, even if it's just a mild problem.
Absolutely.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here along with urologist Dr. Jessica Panessa. And we're talking about enlarged prostate glands and now a new treatment for it. Let's go back to this idea of when should you seek medical care? Let's say you're starting to notice some of these issues, you know, the problems with urination, the frequency, all of the things you described earlier.
When men start to notice early symptoms of prostate enlargement, it's recommended that they see their healthcare provider. Oftentimes, men may not know that they have a problem, and it may be discovered later when they're under the care of a physician for other reasons.
So any of the things you mentioned before, like something about the difficulty, the slow urination or the difficulty starting a stream or potentially blood in the urine or great pain, you should definitely go see a doctor. But when
Absolutely.
Is it an emergency? Because there are times when it really is an emergency. When should you seek emergent medical care?
Whenever there is significant bleeding, an inability to urinate completely, or any signs of an infection, fever.
Because it could lead to what? What happens if you don't seek medical care at that moment?
Men who are in urinary retention can eventually experience renal failure or kidney failure. There's also the possibility of developing sepsis if they're not able to empty their bladder and there's an infection in the urine.
So they would go into complete body shock or a very severe consequence of that.
Absolutely.
So let's go to the treatment now. There have been numerous types of treatment. Sometimes they do lifestyle changes, some medications. But getting back to surgery, which is your specialty specifically, what has been done historically to treat this problem?
So the, like you mentioned before, the TURP, or the transurethral resection of the prostate, is the gold standard for treating BPH, and that therapy focuses on essentially creating a channel by scraping away the tissue through the center of the enlargement tissue, or what would be like the fruit of the orange, like we had talked about before. There are other therapies that are based on laser vaporization of the prostate, where the laser heats the tissue and essentially boils away a portion of tissue that also creates a channel through the enlargement tissue.
So what the channel does is allow the urethra then to pass unobstructed in its normal course, and therefore the urine is not being blocked.
Right. After a channel is created through the enlargement tissue, urine is able to pass with urine is able to pass more freely.
So what is this new procedure? What's it called and what is it?
So the procedure that I specialize in is called the HOLEP, or holmium laser enucleation of the prostate. And this procedure differs from the other procedures that are available in that it is an anatomic dissection. And what I mean by that is the enlargement tissue, or the fruit of the orange, is removed completely, as opposed to just creating a channel through the enlargement tissue. The way that I describe it to my patients is, imagine taking your finger and going between the fruit and the peel of the orange in order to shell out the fruit. I essentially do the same thing using a high-powered laser, and I'm able to remove all of the obstructing tissue. And then that tissue is advanced into the bladder, where a different instrument called a morcellator can cut the tissue into very small pieces and remove it from the bladder using suction. And then all of that tissue is collected and sent to a pathologist who can look at it under the microscope and ensure that there are no additional things we need to worry about, like cancers.
Yeah, and what, how much, you know, what incidence do you find cancer in those circumstances?
The numbers vary based on the based on what you read, but about 10% of patients.
And you're saying that, but is that a cancer we should worry about? Or in other words, what happens then? Because obviously they're not coming in for cancer. There was no diagnosis of cancer. It was basically just an enlarged prostate. So what happens then when you found cancer as a result of this procedure?
So typically we do screen for prostate cancer before performing surgery in many of our patients, but oftentimes even after screening and sometimes even after prostate biopsy, a cancer is not identified until after the HOLEP procedure and the specimen is examined by the pathologist. In those circumstances, the patient can be counseled based on the amount of cancer found, how aggressive it is. And if they are a candidate for treatment, or if they desire treatment, it doesn't preclude them from having either surgical removal of the prostate for cancer, which would be a prostatectomy, or radiation therapy. And many of these patients are found to have a low volume, low-grade disease, and they can actually be candidates for active surveillance.
So basically, they may just outlive their cancer, so to speak.
Absolutely.
So tell me about what's the benefit of this procedure as opposed to the earlier procedures or the prior procedures?
This procedure offers, like I said before, an anatomic dissection, which doesn't leave any blocking tissue to regrow. And so the effects are long-lasting, whereas many of the other procedures offered will have reoperation rates within a 5 to 10 year period. With the HOLEP procedure, we actually see an incredibly low reoperation rate, even in patients who've had this procedure more than a decade ago.
So in all, it's basically the it's more effective in a sense at solving the problem, but continuing to solve the problem long term.
Absolutely. And another significant advantage is that many of the other therapies that are offered are limited based on the size of the prostate. And so beyond a certain size, patients are no longer candidates for a minimally invasive procedure and would require an open procedure, which is much more, which has much higher morbidity. This allows treatment of any size prostate, even those that would typically have to have open surgery.
So there are a lot of benefits. Is it being done a lot of places in this region?
Actually, I'm not aware of any places within the region that are offering this procedure aside from at the community campus for upstate.
Well, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate all this information, and Very important. A lot of men are suffering from this. Thanks so much. My guest has been Dr. Jessica Panessa, Assistant Professor of Urology at Upstate Medical University. Next up, the continuing dangers of lead to our children and what to do about it. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with you. Lead poisoning continues to be the number one environmental poison for children in New York State. And in addition to concerns regarding the lead paint found in older homes, there is an additional concern about lead levels in our soil. Joining us this morning to help us better understand these dangers and what can be done about them is Dr. Howard Weinberger. He's an emeritus professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and the medical director of the Central and Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Prevention Resource Center. Welcome, Dr. Weinberger. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for asking me.
So let's do a quick review for our listeners. What is lead? What is lead poisoning?
Well, lead is an element, you know, that's been used for hundreds, thousands of years in our society, and it doesn't deteriorate. So wherever it is, it stays there forever. And the history of lead in this country specifically is a public health success story. Basically, we removed a significant amount of lead in the air back in the 1970s when leaded gasoline was banned. And that helped remove about a third of all the lead exposure for everybody, both children and adults. The problem for children is that it led in paint, which was used all the way up until the late 1970s, in indoor and outdoor paint, stays as a potential source of hazard for young, particularly for young children. And so what we find is that as housing stock deteriorates, the paint dries, it checkers, and it gets peels off, and it also becomes available to children in aerosolize when you open and close a window frames in an old wooded house. So the problem with lead is ongoing, and I'll talk to you about the incidents in New York State in a minute, but it's a, in one way, it's a public health success story because the levels of lead that we have seen in the past are not seen anymore. On the other side is that we learn more and more about the hazards of even low lead levels in children.
And so what are some of the dangers that lead causes if it's somehow absorbed into our bodies?
Right. So the major concern we have now is on the neurologic system, on the brain and developing brain, particularly in young children. But lead affects the blood system. It affects the formation of red cells. It affects the GI system. It affects the kidneys. But again, I think the main concern we always have is on the effect on the central nervous system. And it's cumulative. It occurs over time. And unfortunately, once it happens, it's irreversible.
So the fact is it continues to, as you said, it grows in the body if you have continued exposure.
Right.
The earlier stuff doesn't deteriorate or go away. And basically, whatever damages it causes are not soluble.
That's exactly right. So that's why prevention is so important.
So it's still happening, though. I read somewhere that even as recently as 2014, you had cases locally.
Well, we still see and hear about children all across New York State because through my position as the medical director of our regional service, I consult on every child whose elevated levels require treatment in the hospital. And that treatment is usually a five-day course of intravenous medication to help eliminate the lead from the body. And so in both 2013 and 2014, I think we had at least a dozen children that we know of in our half of New York State, that's not even counting the western part of the state, who required in-hospital treatment. That means those levels were really very, very high.
And nationally, is this happening as well?
It's still the same problem nationally. The difference in New York State, though, it's important to realize that state by state, the prevalence of leaded housing is different. We have an older state. If you go out to the West Coast, where as many of the communities are relatively new, if housing stock was built after the 1970s, they don't have the lead housing hazard. So when we hear about lead in New York State, it's really a significant issue. And I think it's very important to realize that upstate New York housing, about 75% of the houses were built, wood frame houses were built before the 1970s when the lead legislation was limited.
So when we realized the problem.
So that's a problem that's going to go on well into the future.
And I read somewhere that national surveys currently estimate that there are more than 3 million children 6 years of age and younger who have lead poisoning.
Well, that's because the definition of lead poisoning has changed. It's based, again, on the success. In the past, when we first started doing this, lead levels well in the 40s or 30 to 40 micrograms per deciliter were considered acceptable. Now, we don't consider any lead as acceptable. There is no such thing as a normal blood lead level. So the lower you set the standard, the more children are affected.
So who's most at risk for this? We've been talking children, but it can have a deleterious effect in adults as well.
It sure can. but clearly, our concern is mainly on the child and developing brain, developing nervous system. Sure, adults can get exposed in industry, in the paint industry, and people who work on bridges where they are removing old leaded paint from bridges, in hobbies. Their hobbies are associated with lead. We just recently had a teenage boy who was exposed in a rifle range where he was an excellent student, practicing rifle exercises, and he had an elevated blood lead level just from the exposure of the lead dust in the air.
And are pregnant women more at risk also, and the unborn fetus?
The most recent concerns have really added the issue of the pregnant women, because we know that lead will cross from the pregnant mom to the fetus, developing fetus. In animal studies, there are shows that lead can have deleterious effect on the developing fetus. It's not that clear in the human body, but we do see instances where a pregnant mom has, it's called pica behavior, where she ingests non-food products that may have lead in it. And we've had some very high lead levels in pregnant women. So the ACOG, which is the Association for OBGYNs, has recommended that high-risk pregnant women all should have lead screening done during pregnancy.
And children are being screened on a regular basis as well.
Well, New York State specifically says that all children, not just low-income children, but all children should be tested at 1 and 2 years of age. The reason for that is that if you identify a child who's had a lead exposure by age one, then some kind of housing rehabilitation or removal of the child from that affected environment can be done early on so they don't have continued exposure.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with pediatrician Dr. Howard Weinberger, and we're talking about the dangers of lead poisoning. I also read somewhere that new immigrants who are living perhaps in low-income housing could also have an exposure here.
Well, the issue of new Americans is twofold. One is they come from countries where they don't have the same regulations that we have. So there are still some countries where they use leaded gasoline. Then many of our new Americans coming to Syracuse have lived in refugee camps. They don't get exposed to leaded paint the way we do here in Syracuse, but they get exposed through home remedies, through spices, through unbeknownst to the family that they're using cosmetics. Some of them have very high lead contact, which are culturally appropriate in their culture, but they are not aware of. So the CDC, which is the Centers for Disease Control, have recommended guidelines, you can't say regulations, but that all children under age 16 coming to the United States from another country should have a lead level within a month of arrival here in the States.
And you're saying no level is acceptable.
Right. The problem you mentioned before is that once they get settled in the United States, unfortunately, they're often settled in homes that may have been older homes with lead. So we now are required to retest all those children within 6 months after arrival here to make sure they don't get exposed after they come to the States.
So what about the soil? Because we mentioned that as something I hadn't heard before. I knew about the lead paint.
Well, the soil issue has been around for a long time for several reasons. Remember I mentioned about leaded gasoline. So when there was leaded gasoline, lead went up in the air and then dropped down into the soil. And so the closer you were living to a highway, the closer you were living to a freeway, or the closer you lived to an urban center, the dirt around those homes, the soil around those homes, was found to have higher amounts of lead. So that's an old issue.
So remains an issue as well.
But it still remains an issue because lead, as I said, doesn't deteriorate. Now, as we see some of these older homes start to deteriorate, the eaves under the roofs and the windowsills, some of that peeling paint drops into the drip line around the house. And we've seen and heard cases of children playing in the dirt outside their own home or outside a neighbor's home. It may not even be their own home, where the house paint has deteriorated into the dirt and they're playing there and unknowingly get dirt on their hands. They don't even put the paint chips into their mouth, but they can get enough dirt on their hands to absorb that kind of lead over a period of time.
So what are the symptoms that you would have to recognize that somebody's got a higher lead level or perhaps poisoning?
Okay, so the issue there, again, is a complicated one. There are no symptoms early on. I can't make a clinical diagnosis of lead poisoning by looking at a child. They have to get a blood test. Again, back in the past, when we saw children who had extremely high levels, they would have seizures, they would have convulsions.
So at high levels, there are very clear symptoms.
Horrible, horrible, right.
But it's too late by then.
Exactly right. So we don't want to wait for that to happen. So the early signs and symptoms are really very, very subtle. And that's why we say every child should have a blood lead test at 1 and 2 years of age.
But the truth is, besides the serious health concerns that they may have, they also can have learning disabilities, mental retardation, behavioral problems, lowered intelligence, stunted growth, hearing impairment, and then at the very high levels, convulsions and all the things you mentioned.
So the research that I think has added new knowledge is the issues of the behavioral concerns that much more subtle associations with lead. And unfortunately, it's really very difficult to prove in individual cases because unfortunately, many of the children we see who have had lead exposure also had anemia as young infants. They may have been born prematurely. They may be living with poor nutrition. And so in individual cases, it's very difficult to prove a causative effect. But in research, with looking at populations of children who have lead levels in the, I give you numbers, in 10 to 15 micrograms per deciliter, those children don't do as well at school. They have behavior problems. They have more incidents of delinquency when they're teenagers. There's an associated with violence as young adults.
Wow.
And this is all new information that we've
very
seen.
Very pervasive. I don't want to run out of time. How do you treat it? You mentioned chelation, or you mentioned some way of getting it out of the blood.
Right.
If you find it early enough, or at any point, can you successfully remove it?
Well, no. What you do is remove the child from the exposure. So what we do is limit exposure or stop the exposure, and then lead levels will come down on their own as long as it hasn't been very high. I always say it depends on how long the exposure has been and how high the exposure was before you recognize it.
But are there drugs you can use as well?
The ones we use usually require hospitalization, right?
And they're called chelators.
It's called chelating.
They bind to the lead.
That's right. They bind to the lead, and then you allow it to be excreted through the kidney, right?
So very quickly, in the little bit of time we have left, how do you prevent this? What do you do? What do you recommend?
It's still public health education. Health departments around New York State, certainly our own health department in Onondaga County, very actively engage with education. Remember, every new baby, every new mother is new to this problem.
Right.
And so even though it's an old story for me,
and a continuing story.
It's new for every new baby. So information is presented in multiple ways, literature, through WIC clinics, through prenatal counseling, through a variety of other settings.
So you have to really watch. You have to know whether your baby is being exposed. You have to know if you live in an older house and you have peeling paint, that should be in some way mitigated without you being there because you don't want the dust in the air
exactly,
at the time.
Exactly.
And you really need to kind of be aware of the potential for this kind of
right. And if you're
exposure.
Doing anything to remediate a problem in your home, it should be done professionally.
Mm-hmm.
It should be done by people who know how to do it safely, because that, I think, is the worst problem is you have lead in the paint and it's not bothering anybody, and then you start
to disrupt it,
and you create a problem. And so we've seen that happen unknowingly by really well-meaning people. And over again, what happens is the child and sometimes the adult in the family gets lead poisoned.
Unbelievable. Well, thank you so much for coming in. This is always very instructive, very helpful, and important information. My guest has been Dr. Howard Weinberger, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and the Medical Director of the Central Eastern New York State Lead Poisoning Prevention Resource Center. Once again, thanks a lot. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's checkup from the neck up. You're doing what? Or want to know what I think? Well, folks, my parents grew up on hard scrabble farms and wanted their kids to be professionals, doctor, lawyer, accountant. I was a good student, but in college, I decided I wanted to be, surprise, mom and dad, a filmmaker. I was pretty good. But the film biz is, whoa, competitive. So the next 3 years, I lived with my folks, got a week's work here and there, earned just enough for gas and movie tickets before I learned I wasn't Steven Spielberg, the sequel. Now, I marvel at how my folks made only occasional grumbles about other careers, despite what must have been quite difficult emotionally given their goals for me. While my journey with them was a typical transition from adolescence to adulthood, it turns out they're giving me loving room to travel down my blind alleys was early preparation 101 for one of the greatest challenges psychologists or anyone faces when we witness friends, family, clients making choices that bring emotional and/or physical damage to themselves and others. In my 30-plus years as a psychologist, what have I learned about what we can say or do to make a difference if we love someone who makes damaging decisions? This is a vast oversimplification, but to start, know that we have to take good care of ourselves because these situations can be intensely stressful and it doesn't help to get dragged down ourselves. And have compassion for the person. Beneath that difficult to destructive, provocative behavior is a person in pain doing all sorts of stuff to avoid that pain. And know that we have little or no influence unless the other person is curious about what we think. And know that maybe the best way to awaken curiosity about changing is being loving instead of attacking. Through the disastrous smash-ups, even though we are hurting and angry too, while still acknowledging the person's right to choose. Perhaps saying something like, "It hurts me to watch you do this. If you ever want to talk, I'm here." And know this is hard, 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 because along the way, we have to confront our own helplessness and lack of control in the face of possible great loss and maybe even death. And know that accepting our own feelings without attacking may be useful, because at least our loved one won't have the smoke and fire of arguing to distract from their misery and block their view of a different path. Good luck. I'm Dr. Rich, still here hoping, O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
The stigma and concern about depression in our healthcare trainees. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. is Upstate's HealthLink on Air, Linda Cohen joining you. Despite great efforts to dispel it, there remains a large stigma against mental illness in this country. And though it seems ironic, the stigma continues to remain high among the very people often charged with recognizing it and providing treatment for mental illness, so much so that it often goes unrecognized or treated, despite its strong occurrence. Joining us to shed some light on all of this is Dr. Omar Musa. He's a resident physician in the Department of Internal Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Musa. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So first, let's say you decided to study or to conduct a research project looking for depression and anxiety in medical students and residents. Tell us about that.
That's true. Definitely depression and anxiety is an important topic, and many times we don't think about it as doctors. Maybe what I mean is that we don't think about it in ourselves. We think about it in our patients. And just before I go into details about this project, I want to tell you more about medicine and becoming a doctor. Like for me, for example, I wanted to be a physician for as long as I can remember. And, you know, there are always the positive sides and the negative sides for any profession. But for me, when I see it, you know, it's a helping profession. It's so rewarding to take care of patients. And from our colleagues, we see that doctors get respect for their work. They are personally satisfied, or maybe most of them. Many say that there's never a dull moment. You know, there's job security. But at the same side, at the same time, you know, there's the negative side, or let me say maybe not negative, but this is the side with every profession that you can see the other side of it, which is, you know, it's there are long training periods. There are it is a stressful profession.
There's a lot of personal sacrifice.
That's true.
First to get there,
right,
and then even in that life,
right.
There's a lot you have to do.
Right, and especially for medicine, there are no shortcuts. You know, to become competent physicians in the future, we need to spend many years in training. And long hours, of course.
Low pay initially.
Well, that's true. Well, interesting to add here is just, for example, finishing medical school and doing residency to become a primary care physician, for example, or finishing a fellowship to become a specialist takes about 11 to 15 years. And by that time, the student loan debts can be up to $300,000.
Yes.
So this
requires
can be stressful.
It requires
a lot of sacrifice.
A lot of
sacrifice
and personal dedication.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a select number of people who will be able to do both.
That's true.
Make that sacrifice and have that level of dedication.
And as I mentioned, it is very rewarding to take care of patients and see them get better. But at the same time, it's a big responsibility, and making errors sometimes can add more stress. And part of the profession is burnout. Like there's a report from early this year that showed that up to 50% of physicians experience burnout at some point during their either training or while practicing. Exactly.
So I guess my question to you is: you did this study obviously for a purpose or a reason.
Correct.
Something motivated you.
Right.
Was it your own observations, both from your own life and also those of your colleagues? What motivated you to look at these issues in medical students and residents?
So during my training here in Upstate, we have what we call continuity clinic. We see patients during our training, and many of them, they have depression and anxiety.
The patients.
But for me, I was thinking at some point, what about us? What about doctors? Like, and to take care of those patients, I'm sure that we need to be in a better standing or better health to be able to understand our patients and take care of them. And at the same time, I see the students who work with us. And I remember myself when I was in med school and all the stress I go through. We go through a lot of anxiety, and we feel down sometimes, but we never thought of maybe checking ourselves or testing ourselves or going to a doctor telling him that, oh, I feel depressed. So I talked to my research mentor here in Upstate. He's Dr. Ahmed Damoun. He's the associate program director. And one of our students was working with us. Her name is Sarah Lander. She graduated this year. We thought of looking at the rates of depression and anxiety in medical students, as well as my colleagues, the residents here in the institution. And we looked at previous reports and we found that it was really not well studied. If you look at data in the literature over the past 4 to 5 decades since 1970s, there are not good reports.
And one wonders why that might be. And one thing that strikes me is what we talked about in the beginning, mm-hmm. that somehow the stigma that's attached to mental right. illness mm-hmm. might preclude a doctor from self-diagnosing or self-disclosing.
That's true.
Does that make sense?
That definitely makes sense. I don't think even if we feel down, we will have the courage to report it because we want to be in a very good shape and we want to be positive all the time for our patients and for their health.
There may be some worry, too, it strikes me, mm-hmm. that it could negatively impact on your professional goals because of the stigma. I mean, I don't know that that actually is true, but mm-hmm. one would imagine that if you found yourself in a serious depression during mm-hmm. any of this training period right. and self-disclosed, mm-hmm. that potentially that in your record down the road could have some negative impact. Do you see that as a potential as well?
I do see that. Yes, I agree with you.
So anyway, you had decided to do this research project. So tell us what you did.
So what we decided to do is we used the screening tools for depression and anxiety that we use on a daily basis in the outpatient clinic. And previous studies looked at symptoms of depression. There are different screening tools out there, but we picked one that we use in the clinic, and it has good sensitivity, good specificities that can tell us good info. And our goal was not to diagnose depression or anxiety. Our goal was to screen, just to see if there are any rates of depression and anxiety. And we developed an online survey, and we emailed it through the Graduate Medical Education Office to all the medical students and all the medical residents in our institution.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen here with medical resident Dr. Omar Musa, and we're talking about the incidence of depression and anxiety among medical students and residents. So you emailed it.
Yes.
And this was an anonymous
online survey. Yeah. And it didn't mention that this is a screening survey. It didn't say that we're looking at depression or anxiety. We just mentioned that we're looking at the quality of life of my colleagues, my residents, and our students. And we involved these the questions and the screening tools in the survey. And we received a good number of responses. And just before I tell you the results, I want to tell you in the general population what are the rates here in the United States. And just to make it simple, if you look at 100 people having dinner at the Cheesecake Factory, you'll find that 7 of them have depression. And,
so 7 out of 100.
Yes, and 3 of them have anxiety. So when we looked at these rates, 7 out of 100, correct. When we looked at the rates at our institution or the residents and the students, we found that the rate for depression was 3 times higher, and the rates for anxiety was up to 7 times higher than the general U.S. population. And why we're talking about these numbers, why it is higher, why it is important to us, because this can definitely lead to devastating consequences, including suicide.
Obviously.
Right.
Let me ask you a little bit more about your how you undertook the study. How many total people were actually included sure. in the study?
Mm-hmm. So there are about more than 500 residents. The response rate was typical for a physician survey, let me say, about 25% responded. But for the medical students, we received about 85% responses out of the 400 medical students.
So basically, this was balanced for gender, ethnicity, and all of that?
We included everybody.
So it was really kind of a random, sample.
Yeah, it's hard to randomize just, you know, for the sake of sample size. We wanted to get the higher number.
So ultimately, your conclusions were?
So the conclusion is that, as we saw, there are higher rates of depression and anxiety. But the thing is that we're not saying this is just Upstate. This is not just SUNY Upstate. this is comparable to other studies. There are differences in the design. In our study, we looked at screening. We used screening tools. But the important message here and the conclusion is that the rates are definitely higher than the general U.S. population, and we need to raise awareness among the students and the residents about these higher rates. And we would want them to not to remain quiet. There are certain services that can help. There are support services for the medical students that are free of charge. They can go talk about stress management, time management, their anxiety, their exams. They receive the help they need. And actually, if the supervisors in the support services office feel that this certain student needs more help, they can refer them to the psychiatrist.
So that's true for medical students, but how about when you get to the level of residency? Is it as acceptable? Right. I guess that's going back to this whole notion of stigma.
Right.
I'm not even talking very specifically about the local circumstance. I'm just talking about more in general. Would it be acceptable for someone in a position of residency or even beyond residency, fellowship or beyond, to self-disclose within their training institution?
I think it'll be difficult, and that's why here in Upstate there's support services that are available online, and there's a free phone number to call, and this service is anonymous as well. Like, they will not know who's.
So you could secure some support or perhaps even some therapy in quotation marks in an anonymous fashion?
Correct.
Interesting. So what did you find? There was an additional finding that I thought was interesting. What did you find in these screening tools that suggested what people were doing to relieve the stress and anxiety?
Right. So part of the, we added some questions to look at what people do and, you know, the regular stuff like watching movie, doing some sports, listening to music. But the significant part in this question is that we found about one-third of the students and residents used alcohol to relieve their stress. And this can be significant.
It can lead to alcoholism or any kind of issues long life,
it is
long term.
Yes.
And perhaps affect the way it would impair their ability to take care of patients.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, I wonder if self-awareness that might come of this kind of these kinds of screening devices or even the permission to self-disclose might help with people being more empathic and perhaps being more effective in their help of others.
That's true.
So I guess in the very little bit of time we have left, what would be your recommendation? What do you think as a result of these findings?
I recommend that the students and my colleagues, the residents, to talk to their friends, talk to their families, not to just remain quiet. And I think it's reasonable to just use this screening tool or just talk to your primary care doctor.
Basically, you're saying open your mouth.
Open your mouth.
Come out of hiding.
Many times, these disorders go unnoticed, and we don't know about them until the stage gets really advanced and
A lot of potentially negative consequences, both for the student and also for their future patients.
Right, because we need to make sure to remember that as. This really affects our patients' safety, patient care, and
Absolutely.
That's from in the first place. That's why we went into med school and into this profession.
Well, I thank you so much for coming in. It's very enlightening. Let's hope this kind of study will generate the need for more studies and perhaps open the conversation at large within the within medical training programs.
Hopefully, and thank you very much.
My guest has been Dr. Omar Musa. He's a resident physician in the Department of Internal Medicine at Upstate Medical University. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. Cancer is a 24/7 forever companion, and not in the sweetest sense of that word. To be sure, it can bring out the good, the noble, the profound. and it can also make us wild with fury and fear. Rita Cerisi is a novelist and short story writer who directs the creative writing program at the University of South Florida. She gave us two short essays that reveal the underbelly of cancer's effect on us. Here is Swindled, followed by Cancer Does Not Bring Out the Best in Us. Swindled. In the family room, there's a Keurig coffee maker and a vending machine that dispenses plastic pods of house blend, French vanilla, green tea, and dark chocolate. Dollar bills only, it reads. Over the long course of your illness, I feed dollar after dollar into this machine and hunker down on the sagging sofa, nursing my half-hot drink and watching Beat the Clock and You Bet Your Life and The Price is Right and Let's Make a Deal. One day, I open my wallet and find only a five, so I take a chance and feed it into the dollar bill only slot. When the machine swallows my five but does not deliver my French vanilla, I burst into shameful tears. You're dying, but all I can think is, I want my money back. Cancer does not bring out the best in us. The doctor looks back and forth between my sister and me. Which of you is his mother? I thank God my sister is the one who has to say, I am.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Join us again next week when we examine the connection between social media use and depression, plus new help for bone marrow transplants, and optic neuritis and multiple sclerosis, a dangerous duo. HealthLink on Air is directed by Amber Smith and produced by Steve Marks, with sound engineers John Miller and Gerard Roy. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.